Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means it is Week in Review, and so many serious stories to review this week. There's a scandal as the RMB spills over into a Beacon Hill hearing.
We do want to get to some answers at this point.
This is not about whether we will be cooperating with the oversight of this committee. It's about
that.
When.
Right.
We've had lots of conversations with the legislature. We are certainly encouraging people to come and testify.
Also this week, the federal government announces they're going to resume death penalty executions, while Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley calls to end the practice entirely. And not one, but two tornadoes tore through the Cape, one in Harwich, one in Yarmouth, and the governor has activated the Massachusetts National Guard to help clean up.
I can refer to it as a war zone. I've never seen so many trees, so many wires down, and it happened so fast.
Come inside! Come inside, guys!
This is our 10-week season where we make our living, and we've got to get everything back online as quick as we can.
But before all that, Washington, Mueller, his testimony, and more calls on the left for presidential impeachment.
Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No. People mentioned exoneration. That was something where he totally folded.
The evidence in the Mueller report and the special counsel's testimony explaining it compel us to do what is right, and that is to begin an impeachment proceeding against Donald Trump.
We won't proceed when we have what we need to proceed, not one day sooner.
So with us here in Studio 3 this week is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie! Great to see you.
Wonderful to see you.
Thank you. Really fun to have you here. Also with us is Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Hey, Charlie.
Hello.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
All right. And we're trying something new with Week in Review, which is your calls, starting with Mueller. What did you make of the hearings? Did you learn anything new? What stood out to you? Call us. You can call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet at us, at Radio Boston. All right. So we have a lot to get to. Almost a full day of testimony on Wednesday with Mueller. What are your takeaways? Marie?
Well, I think we are exactly where we started before the hearing. I think Mueller did exactly what he set out to do. He told you he was going to be a hostile witness, that he did not want to do this. He gave you the facts and the law as reported in the report, and that's all he was going to do. And that's what he gave us.
Now, he did not seem like an enthusiastic participant, did he?
He was not going to get caught up in the politics of either side, because both sides were trying to use him politically, and he stayed true to the law and the facts. And that's exactly what he should have done.
Charlie, anything you'd add to that?
Well, I think now maybe we know that one of the reasons he didn't want to testify was perhaps had something to do with the fact that he seems to be not well in some way or a little bit diminished. And, you know, it was only that it was kind of sad to see both sides, I think, frankly, more the Republicans sort of almost trying to go after him, you know, and you know, when he was, as I said, somewhat diminished. It was unseemly, I would say.
So call us. Tell us what you thought about the testimony. Is Marie right that there really wasn't anything new there? Do you agree with Charlie's sense that Mueller somehow seemed diminished or maybe like he wasn't on top of his game? You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So afterward, President Trump once again declared victory. He spoke under the roar of his presidential helicopter on Wednesday and said it was devastating for the Democrats and that Mueller did a horrible job with both the report and the testimony.
He had nothing to work with. You know, you can be a builder, but if they don't give you the right materials, you're not going to build a very good building. Robert Mueller had no material. He had nothing to work with. So obviously he did very poorly today. I don't think there's anybody, even among the fakers, I don't think there's anybody that would say he did well.
So, okay, I 443 pages doesn't mean you have no material, Marie. Obviously, he had some material to work with. But as you say, not sure we learned anything new from the 443. So there were different constituencies looking for Mueller to deliver something. Mm-hmm. Did he deliver anything anyone was looking for?
See, I think the good thing is for folks who had not read the report at all, or even skimmed through it. And I have to say, I skimmed through it. I did not read all 400 pages. It forced you, it pulled some key facts around whether or not there was a conspiracy. It pulled some key facts, whether or not there was obstruction of justice. It pulled up and highlighted key facts around the issue of the Russian involvement in our politics, and particularly in our elections. So I think it laid that out. Those were the facts. That's what he was asked to unveil, and that's what he did. So it forced us to take a look at that. So in that, I think the Democrats could say, okay, great, we got an opportunity for us to read, because he didn't read it. They read it. I mean, they read the report to the public. I think it did that.
So let's hear him making this assertion about, hey, you are going to get what I already gave you.
We stated the results of our investigation with precision. We scrutinized every word. The report is my testimony, and I will stay within that text.
Okay, Charlie, but there was at least some boiling down during the testimony.
Yes.
And as Marie says, you heard different pieces and different voices. It was almost like an audiobook at some points.
Right.
Was there value to this boiling down, this more consumable version of the facts?
I think there was, because on some level, I've come to think that, you know, I don't know if arrogance is the right word, but, you know, we don't live in a world where you can just write 448 pages and then you can just sort of wash your hands of it. The reality is that, you know, at least 97% from the polls I've seen of the people in this country did not read that report. Mm-hmm. They don't know what's in it. Basically, they're getting what's in that report either from MSNBC or from Fox. And so, you know, I think that people needed to actually hear in plain language what's in that report. And I do think that there's value in that.
You can also get it from NPR, I'm just saying.
Well, you can. You can. I'm not sure a lot of the people that we need to hear it listen to NPR, I'm sad to say.
And so, Marie, you know, we had a lot of conversation about the political reasons for this and the oversight reasons for this. But what I think I'm hearing from both of you is that was actually an educational moment, that was actually kind of the point of the testimony.
I think there was a significant, I remember as a child sitting with my father watching the Watergate hearings, right? And so that sort of reminded me, and it was boring, because that's my recollection as a child, right? And so I think that for those folks who actually took the time and listened in, I think there was an opportunity for it was an educational experience, and that was important.
Well, here's the bad news, because I was 13 that summer watching those things, and I was sitting there then thinking, this is so great. This is fascinating. So we knew early on that I was going to be
a nerd. That you were a total wonk.
I didn't think it was fascinating.
Well, I love me the wonks. Maybe we've got some callers who are wonks. Let's take a call. Craig from Plymouth, tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. So, I think it's important that, you know, the media look at this as a wonk. Crimes were committed. It's documented again and again. And we're doing a disservice to the justice system by saying that, you know, the optics look so-and-so for either side. The objective truth is that crimes were committed, and the American people need to be aware of that.
Craig, thanks for that. And to your point, this gives me a chance to bring in some audio from a conversation we had yesterday with Congressman Seth Moulton. He's running for president himself, and we asked him about sort of what service this did.
The lesson we learned from Nixon is that only by opening a proceeding and by getting more evidence before the American people, before Congress in these hearings, are we able to make the case stronger and move public opinion.
So as you guys both said, and as Craig said on the line, you know, you got to take a deep dive into this, comb the stuff out, approach it like a wonk. I also want to note, though, that when he says the case stronger in that quote, he means the case for impeachment. But at least according to a recent poll, Washington Post, ABC, just earlier this month, 60% of Americans almost said the House should not begin impeachment proceedings. Do you think this testimony and all that came after it this week is going to move the needle on that public opinion? Charlie, what do you think?
I don't think so. I don't think it's going to. I think from a, you know, there are certainly the civics issue that when you get to a certain point, a certain, amount of evidence, you're going to need to move on that. But I don't think we're at that point yet. And I think that as much as I may dislike Donald Trump and not want him to be president, I think that to go forward without a very, very strong case would really be politically a disaster.
I mean, we impeached Clinton over Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
So, I mean, please, over a dress, right? And so the idea that this guy, who you have, you know, pages and pages and pages of documented wrong, should not be impeached. To me, that does not make any sense. But my problem is not that he shouldn't be impeached. I think that they've waited too long. And my problem is that I think that this wishy-washy can't make a decision business has continuously dragged the country into further division. And so as a result, we are now in a position where we have camps, rather than a country looking at what's in its best interest, we have various camps that have solidified, and they can't, and we would never move to a place as a country in this particular instance where we can say, yes, let's impeach this guy and we're all going to stand with it. So my thing is, if you want to open an investigation, open it to get more information. But while we're playing that game, a lot of our own values are being destroyed on a daily basis, and there's no light being shined on that. In particular, we're about to have an election. We are not putting up doing anything to make certain that those elections will be credible at the end of the day. And that to me is, you don't need folks coming over the Boston Harbor to take us out. We will be taken out by the way we handle our democracy and protect it. And we're not doing that here today.
So, Marie, there is such a sense of urgency in what you're talking about. One of the countermeasures to that has been the very methodical approach that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi continues to want to take. We've got some tape of her sort of talking about, well, let's just run it.
Everybody has the liberty and the luxury to espouse their own position and to criticize me for trying to go down the path in the most determined, positive way. Again, their advocacy for impeachment only gives me leverage.
So she's,
I have no complaint with what they are doing.
I almost just interrupted the Speaker of the House.
You'll be punished.
Right. So she says that. And then in the tape we had at the top, she basically says, we will do this when I think we should do this, when I say we will do this, when it's the right time to do this. So, Charlie, this push and pull for liberals. Let's keep in mind that conservatives and Republicans are arguing there is no there, and everybody's in vapors, right? Where is their urgency here, and how do we get at that as a country?
Well, there's a lot of urgency on a lot of different levels. It's just that there's everybody has different urgency. I would say, obviously, the left is very, and some people like me who are not on the left are, you know, are, it's a big issue because we strongly don't believe this guy should be president of the United States. But, you know, there's a lot of urgency in the Trump campaign because, look, I think everything that is happening now and everything that's happening going forward, look, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's about one thing. I think it's about that Donald Trump will do anything to get reelected so that the statute of limitations tolls on all the stuff that he's done while he's still in office, because if he's out, he's going to jail. So, you know, there's a lot of urgency. It's just all conflicting instead of uniting.
So we have a caller, actually, who has something to say about that. Joanna from Peabody. Go ahead. Tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up the statute of limitations, because that's the part that really stuck out to me with the testimony. It seems like if there's a special case for one person to not be indictable because he's a sitting president, that there should also be a special case that the statute of limitations is suspended during the time that he's ineligible for indictment. And then that clock could tick again once he's a private citizen.
So
thank you.
So Marie, yeah. Okay, so Joanna, you just scored points with both our panels. They both agree.
And there's a suggestion in the, I believe, in the and the regulation that they're using that alludes to the fact that the statute tolls. But no one has lifted that up yet to talk about it in a specific way.
So we want to hear from you. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. Where are you on impeachment? How important was the testimony this week? Did it change anything for you? That's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. So politically, is impeachment, this is politics now, is impeachment the right move for the Democrats?
No.
Marie?
Not currently.
No. The election is on November 3rd, 2020. By the time, no. at this point, we've wasted too much time. If we wanted to impeach, we should have done that a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. At this point, and is he, should he be impeached? Yes. It's a political piece. Does that mean he leaves office? No. I mean, no, we have the impeachment doesn't necessarily mean he leaves office. What we do need to do is really get focused. All these folks who are elected need to get back to their district, have conversations with their constituents, let them know what's going on so that we can build a case for a real effective groundswell to get this guy out of office in January of 2020.
All right. So, Charlie, Marie just said getting focused. There is another thing that Mueller, arguably in his testimony, really tried to get people to focus on, and that was Russian interference with the 2016 election. Here's Texas Republican Will Hurd asking Mueller about the extent of Russian election meddling during the testimony.
In your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
No, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
So, Charlie, the next day, the Senate Intelligence Committee releases this report on Russia's targeting of our election in 2016, and it's really bad. Mm-hmm. All 50 states targeted. Are we safe in our election in 2020?
No, we're not at all. And it's a remarkable thing that we're seeing right now, where we're having this issue that we're hearing about on the radio every day, seeing it on television, reading it in the newspapers. And everybody's talking about it, but nobody's really doing enough about it. It's just, it's very dangerous thing.
So in the Senate, Republicans blocked two election security bills this week, citing the partisan nature of them. And to this partisan point, then Catherine Clark tweets this week today, parroting Joe Scarborough and calling Mitch McConnell Moscow Mitch for blocking these bills. First, is that going to stick? And does that move us forward? What do we need to do to move forward to make sure we can have a fair and safe election in 2020?
You know, we go around the world telling everybody else how to run elections, right? We tell them that it should be fair, it should be transparent, they should have the right equipment, all of that. Blah, blah, blah. We go and tell the world. Yet we will not take the time. It's been made clear. We don't trust what? We don't trust our own intelligence? Is that what we're saying? So whose intelligence are we going to trust, America? Are we going to trust the Russians' intelligence? When we have all our intelligence agencies telling us that we are at risk and there is no urgency by the people that we've sent to Washington to protect us, then we should be up in arms. And you know, that is the central issue. The bedrock of our democracy is our electoral process. If you can interfere with that and destabilizes that, which is what they're counting on, because if they can continue to make certain that Americans cannot trust the results of the election that's coming up, then they can continue to keep him in office. We're not going to have a moment that we had in 2000. When was it? When Gore?
2000.
When Gore stepped back. That's not what this is going to be. This is going to be very ugly. So I suggest that everybody who's on that hill gets serious about protecting our election. Okay? That's the way you take this guy out.
Well, and the only way that happens is if they hear loud and clear from their constituents that they'd better get serious about protecting these elections.
So our lines are full. We've got people who want us to hear them loud and clear. Let's hear Kenny. I think, Kenny, you're on Route 93 right now, so let's see how this goes. Tell us what's on your mind, Kenny.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It's Teddy. I'm calling just to follow up on your point about protecting our elections. I think we have a very large problem about in what way we want to protect our elections. So Robert Mueller, for example, went up on stage and said several times over and over that he wants a stronger CIA, FBI, and NSA, you know, sort of unity to bring more election integrity. But I think a better idea, which most of the American people might support, is paper ballots. And we've seen that over and over, especially with the recent election problems in Fort Myers, Florida, as well as Stacey Abrams' election in Georgia. Paper ballots would solve a very large issue that we're having in some of our democratic institutions.
So, Teddy, I hear you, but it just brings these visions of hanging chads and, you know, the need to count. There's downsides to paper. Go ahead, Charlie.
I think the reality is, I've done a little bit of work on this. The reality is that there is technology available today that with blockchain and those kind of things that is traceable and that is reliable and does not have the downsides of paper ballots.
All right, let's take a couple more. Jonathan from Newton, go right ahead.
Yeah, the big news out of that hearing is that Mueller completely failed as a prosecutor.
So say a little bit more about that. Where was the failure, Jonathan?
He had the president, he said that he had to have the president answer his questions. It took over a year for him to finally write some questions that were non-responsive. Then he had the choice of going after him with a subpoena, decided not to do that. That's a complete failure of his job.
So, Marie, let's talk about what Jonathan has to say here. Thanks for that, Jonathan.
I agree, I was disappointed too, Jonathan, that the prosecution did not press more in order to get the in order to get the president before them for to be questioned. Let him plead the fifth. They probably had some knowledge that he was going to step forward, but was going to plead the fifth to every question. But I think what I would do is have him step forward and plead the fifth to every one of them. At least you got him on record taking the fifth. The only reason you would take the fifth is because there is some nefarious reason why you can't answer honestly. And so I agree to that extent. But overall. I mean, the idea that they did not want to take the time, because if they did take the time to force him, they would have had to go to court to force him, and it would have gone on forever. Mm-hmm. And we did not want this I would not have wanted this investigation going on through 2020.
And I do think that of the reasons why yesterday was important was because he was asked that question, and Mueller sat there and said, yes, I believe he was non-responsive to many of these questions that we asked him, or that he was not telling the truth.
This is our Friday Week in Review, and still with us in studio is Marie St. Fleur. She's a former Massachusetts state rep and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Marie, welcome.
It's good to be here. Great to be here.
Thanks. And Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Thanks for staying with us, Charlie.
Thank you.
And you, here's what's next. What do you make of the latest RMV scandal this week, the one having to do with the no-shows at the hearing? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, so the RMV. There was a bit of a standoff earlier this week between the Baker administration and the legislature. After a much-anticipated hearing Monday over problems at the RMV really fell apart abruptly. State Senator Joseph Boncori says their goal is to keep the driving public safe and ask the tough questions.
The Committee of Jurisdiction, the Transportation Committee, you know, has a goal here to ask the questions in a public way and ensure we're getting answers. Whatever the fallout that is, let it be. But we have an obligation to the people of this Commonwealth and to our respective chambers to ask these questions, and we plan on doing so going forward.
Okay, so as such, a new hearing is scheduled for next week after state transportation officials refused to share info with lawmakers and key witnesses actually failed to appear. Marie, you've been there. This feels disrespectful considering...
It's absolutely disrespectful. You know, we are co-equal branches of government, and I'm saying we, because I used to be in the legislature.
Exactly. You know what you speak.
You know, you used to have folks come before you. We are the representatives of the people. This is the Registry of Motor Vehicles, which is actually an agency that the public safety is in their trust. And we as their representatives, the representatives have the right to ask the questions. This is a Trump moment. This is a new Trump era where we can disregard a co-equal branch of government and shun your nose at them and pretend they're not there. They should have shown up. They should, if they did not have the appropriate information at the time, make their excuses as they should, but made clear that they would then be coming to take care of it. But to totally disrespect another branch of government is not where we should be going in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I was really taken by this because...
Outrageous.
Not in a good way, I'm assuming.
Well, no, because, you know, I worked in the Romney administration. Marie, you may remember that getting along with the legislature was not exactly the strongest point of the Romney administration.
No.
And I think I was very surprised at this because, you know, one of the reasons I think that Charlie Baker has done well and is a popular governor is that he has worked really well with the legislature. And this just seemed out of character. I just thought this was an odd kind of misstep to allow this to happen.
So how about you? Was this a misstep by Governor Baker? Did we just have a Trump moment in Massachusetts? Call us 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And let's stay with Governor Baker for a second. He has a really interesting quote yesterday when he talked to reporters about this.
We've had lots of conversations with the legislature over the course of the past few days. We are certainly encouraging people to come and testify. We're encouraging people to testify.
So what you heard in the background, what you couldn't hear in the background there was a reporter saying, so are you going to order them? And then, of course, the governor said, we're going to encourage them. That seems week, and this is especially, this is the same week that the Globe reported that the RMV is not regularly complying with a law that requires it to notify local police departments of driver license suspensions and revocations. And there's other really challenging stuff. Is this a smart strategy, Charlie?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my interpretation of it, maybe I'm wrong, is that, you know, they're encouraging these folks to show up, and if that doesn't work, they're going to encourage them to walk down the street to the Hurley building and file for unemployment insurance, you know. But, I think that's the message. I just think he's trying to say it in a more civil way.
All right. Now, Marie, for any other politician, you've got the RMV, you've got the MBTA, you've got the state police. These would be albatrosses around their mm-hmm. necks. What about for Governor Baker? Is he still, as he's sometimes referred to, Teflon Charlie after all this?
Governor Baker has a real knack of being, his administration has a real knack of being able to overcome these. I mean, one of those things should have taken one person out, a Democrat out. But for him, he's been able to overcome them. But I have to say, I mean, I was trying to be balanced on these things. These problems did not show up with Baker. All right. So those problems have been ongoing problems.
The problems in the RMV.
The problems,
state police.
But particularly the state police. The problem with particularly the T have not shown up. My concern is the reaction to it. I'm actually a little taken aback with the RMV in particular because I was a very big fan of Dr. Scott, and if she had gotten a tenth of the support that the RMV folks are getting, maybe would have been in a different place today. But that's just my own personal point of view on that. But no, Charlie has great relationships, and we are a state and a city that's about relationships, and he has nurtured those relationships so people give him that benefit. Some folks in there probably served with him at some point, you know, in his various service on the Hill. So they have an idea of his integrity. They have an idea of how he goes about solving problems, but you don't always control the people that work for you, unfortunately. But again, the buck
stops
with
him. You're still responsible for him.
The buck stops with him.
You know, but I also think there's another thing here, and I don't think it's the whole story by any sense. I think what Marie said is right, but I also think there's a strong strain in Massachusetts of Massachusetts voters liking state leaders who don't want to run for higher office, who want to stay and do what they're doing. And I think you see that when you look at, for example, you know, Elizabeth Warren has been doing very well lately, but she doesn't do so well in the Massachusetts polls, you know. And I think that's a very strong strain in Massachusetts politics. And I think that's part of it.
We've got some calls on this, so let's take some calls. Gary from Worcester, tell us what's on your mind.
Thanks. I'm just surprised when the governor ran and there were problems in the Department of Children and Families, he was all over that. And with this thing, he just seems passionless and missing in action. And I just think there's an incongruity to his performance with this.
Any theories from you, Gary, on why that might be, you know, the disparities and how he's reacting to problems in various parts of the government? And if not, that's fine.
I think it was all, you know, for the means of getting elected.
All right. Thanks for that, Gary. Let's listen to Josh from Plymouth, too. Josh, go ahead and weigh in.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to point something out. I think it's an oversimplification to say this is a something that is Trump era. I just wanted to point out that under the Obama administration, Attorney General Eric Holder refused congressional subpoenas for information for the drug running operation Fast and Furious, and he was acting as Attorney General of the United States, and the Obama administration completely stonewalled the Hill. And so this isn't something that's begun with Trump. And I think it was Marie that made that comment, and it's fashionable to say that, but I don't think it's very accurate.
What do you think of that,
that's
Marie?
That's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, Josh. What do you think of Josh's call, Marie?
Oh, the circumstances to me are very different in terms of why Eric Holder would have taken a stand as it relates to that particular criminal justice issue. In this instance, the information that they were seeking to, they're going to require the assistance of the legislature in order to fix many of the problems that has to be fixed in there. They're going to require funding from the legislature in order to correct it. And so to totally ignore them and not deal with them, I think, is a different aspect. I call it the Trump era, because it is in this new age that it appears that anyone can ignore a subpoena or a request, because it was not even a subpoena. It was just simply a request to come and testify about regular issues that you should be testifying about.
All right. So, Charlie, let's talk about something else that is happening in this new age. On the national scene, the U.S. Attorney General announced this week that the administration is going to resume federal capital punishment this year after not executing anyone since 2003, so 16 years. And then yesterday, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley from here in Massachusetts said on Twitter that she's introducing a bill to abolish the federal death penalty. She said, quote, "The death penalty has no place in a just society," end quote. Now, of course, here in Massachusetts, the death penalty was abolished in 84. Federally, what do you think?
Well, I'm very colored by my own views. I think the death penalty is barbaric, and I think that if I'm all for Ayanna Pressley or anybody else who wants to file legislation to outlaw it.
So let's stay with this for a second longer, because she said a couple more things. She said, quote, "The same racist rhetoric coming from the occupant of the White House who called for the execution of the exonerated five is what led to this racist, vile policy." Then adding, quote, "The cruelty is the point," end quote. Is the cruelty the point of resumption here, Charlie Marie, or is there something else going on?
I think this administration clearly will go to any lengths to sort of play on the resentments of their base. And, nothing's out of bounds, it seems. And so, I think that's true.
I mean, it's good political fodder for how he sets himself up. I agree with Charlie on that. And I think, for me, there's a broader issue here. I mean, I think even when in Massachusetts they try to bring it back, I think many of us stood up against it. Because, again, I think in a civilized society that we're sufficiently advanced that we can find other ways of maintaining justice.
Yeah.
But the other piece is, honestly, death is death. You can't take it back. And we know that this country has a history of racial bias, where there is clear evidence that the majority of people that are often, if we haven't been watching the news in the past even 2 or 3 years, are often stopped or incarcerated, happen to be people of color, which is, which comes out of sort of that whole Jim Crow experience that we've had in this country, that you can't take it back.
So I'm going to move us on to one more topic. But before I do, I do feel like I have to at least represent, the Attorney General is arguing, and Charlie, if you can get just two words on
sure.
this. The Attorney General is arguing fairly, hey, administrations from both parties have sought the death penalty in federal cases for years. Mm-hmm. This is not unique to us. What's your response to that?
Well, no, I mean, look, he's right about that. I just don't think it was the right policy then, and I don't think it's the right policy now.
Okay. All right. So one more topic, if we can, before hubbubs. And, the Cape. Two tornadoes tore through Cape Cod, one in Harwich, one in Yarmouth. The governor has activated the National Guard. Call us if you were impacted. If you saw the tornadoes, we'd love to hear from you. Or even if this has just affected your plans to go to Cape Cod this summer, 1-800-423-8255. One tornado ripped off the roof of the Cape Sands Inn in Yarmouth. And here's an eyewitness speaking to Channel 7. She was in her room when the roof came up.
It's a freak thing. Seen the black cloud coming from the other side. Seen the maintenance man standing up there telling him to get down, get down. That was it. Everything stopped. Watched the flagpole bent. Backed into the room, shut the door. The roof came off, hit the floor, opened the door and ran out.
All right, so we only have a couple of minutes for this, and fortunately no one was seriously hurt. So let me just ask you, what were your reactions when you heard two tornadoes touch down in the Cape on the same day?
Well, my reaction was one of great Catholic guilt, because I was there the week of 4th of July, and it was absolutely beautiful and sunny every day. And I feel terrible for the people who were there who were there this past week. It's just awful. But, the other reaction is just climate change is mm-hmm. coming down the tracks, folks, mm-hmm. and we got a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. Marie.
Yeah, I do. I feel for the families, and particularly the kids who were witness to that. It's supposed to be a joyous time for them. And that's a memory that they have now that we have to figure out how to help them work through. I do think that this is a preview for us. It's a warning. We've had a number of minor ones right out west. And so this, the severity seems to be increasing.
The dumpster floating through the seaport a couple years ago,
so,
right?
So it's coming. And so the question is, how ready are we? And we should be taking this very seriously as a state and city.
So to Marie's point about this being a warning sign, this morning, Ed Markey, Senator Ed Markey, visited Harwich along with Representative Keating, House Speaker DeLeo. It's where one of the tornadoes touched down. Markey said the Cape is open for business, come down, that FEMA and MEMA and everyone will get residents the help they need. But then he said this.
This is no longer an isolated thing. Global warming has turned into global weirding. Crazy things are happening that no one has ever seen before. We have to be prepared for it, and we're ready to help right now.
Okay, so, you know, in a couple of words, how vulnerable is the Cape to climate change? And are we seeing part of a much bigger and more dangerous pattern?
I think, you know, New Orleans, the Cape, I mean, they're among the very top tier of places that are the most vulnerable to climate change.
And Marie, you were saying.
And I think it's the beginning. It's a preview. I think after Katrina, there was a lot of activity. We were doing all sorts of modeling to figure out what the impact would be should climate change occur, who would be hit first, what the impact would be on Boston, what would be the cap on the Cape. I think that we've taken a step back, and we need to renew the energy around figuring out how we protect our citizens, because it's not that it's not coming. It's coming that we have a game plan.
It takes Sandy, Katrina, those kind of events, you know, but we've got to sustain it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're up here in Boston today, but listeners down on the Cape, goodness sake, sharks, tornadoes, yeah. Heat. We are with you. We're thinking of you. Just what a tough couple of weeks.
Yeah.
All right. When it's been tough, sometimes it's nice to end with our hubbubs, which is those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Marie, I saw a line about yours. I'm dying to hear this. Let's go.
So I want to say my hubbub is how do you relieve stress? And it's to hug a cow.
To hug a cow.
To hug a cow. And
that appeals to the Midwest.
And there is a Airbnb or bed and breakfast up in upstate New York for $75 an hour. If you're feeling stressed, you can go hug a cow.
All right.
And feel better.
So, Charlie, are you cow hugging? What's yours this
well,
week?
Well, I don't know about cow hugging, but you know, mine comes from, you know, my kids are big fans of the longtime internet meme, Florida Man. And so I couldn't help but notice when, yes, a Florida man was arrested recently after breaking into a Wendy's, and he breaks in, but he doesn't just go around and steal stuff. Instead, he fires up the grill, makes himself a burger, and then casually starts wandering around and deciding what it is that he wants to take. So this modern-day hamburglar was caught and is currently sampling the cuisine at the Martin County Jail in Florida.
I love that.
I thought the hamburglar was a McDonald's thing, though.
Well,
isn't
that's
it?
True, but yeah. You know, we do the best we can.
All right, so I do have a hubbub of my own. So you may have heard that there was a group that's been planning a straight pride parade next month. And they recently attacked TripAdvisor, the company, for hating the straight for not sponsoring the event. The group the group claims that heterosexuals are actually victims of inequities. And they had used a bunch of corporate logos on their materials, claiming that they were in conversations with these companies to sponsor them, which the companies weren't doing. So the companies then produced cease and desist letters, right? Now, the fact that this is happening at all, this event, is a story. But the hubbub here is the cease and desist letter that TripAdvisor wrote in particular. In a subtle slapdown of the parade organizers and in a show of solidarity with the LGBTQ plus community, they wrote this letter and laced it with no fewer than 17 references to songs that the LGBTQ community has adopted as gay anthems. So, you know, our logo is well-respected around the country and over the rainbow. There were multiple references to Cher. And then, of course, we had to have a little bit of Diana Ross. It was cheeky. We're dancing in here, folks. You should join us. It was cheeky. It was creative. And it took two firm stands against the organizers and their messages at once. I loved it. I loved it. And we got Diana Ross.
TripAdvisor is a lot hipper than I am, I'll tell you that.
All right, Marie St. Fleur, she's a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Thanks, Marie.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yep, and Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Charlie, thanks.
Thanks, Tatiana.
All right, so stay with us. Coming up, the Yankees are in town. We'll check in on the series and what it means for the Red Sox season. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.